Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
First there was flour until it ran out. Then we could get wheat and that ran out. Then corn kernels. Then we tried animal feed. Now my mom makes us a pudding with water and starch, and we eat that.
Hunger, malnutrition, and man-made catastrophe in Gaza. It's Friday, March 22nd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. At the end of the show, we've got some recommendations for your bookshelf if you're even remotely into sci-fi. And before that, why is the House Freedom Caucus threatening to blow up another budget deal on immigration?
Any Republican who votes for this bill, they own it, and they are the ones risking the election.
Before we get to all that, though, we've been following the warnings from aid groups of famine in Gaza. And even without a formal declaration of famine, we know Palestinians are already dying of disease, hunger, and malnutrition. At the top of the show, you heard 14-year-old Youssef Tafish speaking to NPR. Situations like his are the result of war between Hamas and Israel, but also Israeli policy that restricts shipments of aid into Gaza, including food. For some context on how war has contributed to famines in history, we called up someone who has studied the issue. Yara Asi is an assistant professor at the University of Central Florida and co-director of the Palestine Program for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University. Here's her conversation with Celeste Headley.
I want to go back to this phrase that we're hearing a lot from aid groups. Famine is imminent in Gaza. Mm-hmm. But we know that hundreds of thousands of Gazans are right now experiencing really devastating levels of hunger. At what point does it reach that threshold of famine?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, this is not a natural disaster. This is something that we can kind of watch happening. And so as in the early 2000s, in other instances of famine, we designated this global kind of food security alarm system called the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. And their job is to keep an eye on instances of food insecurity, starvation, and eventually famine to warn external actors of what is coming. With regard to Gaza, they have indicated that this is the most acute and quickest incidence of food insecurity in their records since they have been recording this. So their job is to kind of tell the rest of us what they're seeing. The job of those on the outside is to prevent that from happening.
Nonprofit organizations have been putting up flags for some time now. Why do you think the impacts, the public health impacts of this war are being overlooked in large part?
Yeah, so as early as December 18th, Human Rights Watch issued a report that explicitly said starvation is being used as a weapon of war in Gaza. Our understanding of war and armed conflict is typically kind of the spectacle of bombings, of tanks in the streets, of these kinds of, you know, very visceral, viewable acts of violence. What is often missed is that most people die in armed conflict and war from indirect causes like starvation, like infectious disease, lack of access to clean water, any of the other breakdowns of society and infrastructure that we're seeing in places like Gaza. But those are much easier to look at in retrospect. In the moment, we're kind of just tracking trends day to day. But it is alarming that even with just a few months or weeks into this, these kinds of groups are saying we can already see that starvation is a man-made, human-made catastrophe in the Gaza Strip and is consistently getting worse. People were trying to make things work for several weeks or months initially with what they had. Things have deteriorated now such that, especially in the north, there is literally no access to food. So the clock is really ticking for these people.
So many officials in governments around the world have said it's impossible to know whether Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. Why, especially historically speaking, why has it been difficult to prove this?
Well, I think we need to take that into two parts. I think, one, a lot of the same countries that are being hesitant to call out Israel's actions or the consequences of their actions are doing so in large part because they have supported Israel militarily, financially, and diplomatically. And so admitting that their ally is using these tactics would be, in some ways, holding themselves complicit and enabling this behavior. But I think when we look back at history, especially more recent history, when we look at areas of other famine and mass starvation, I'm thinking Haiti, Sudan, Yemen, many of the times, these are non-state militias that are besieging territories, or there are other external factors that are leading to starvation, like in Haiti, earthquake, or, you know, kind of mass violence and insecurity in the streets. I think in those cases, we are much more willing to see the actions of, you know, actors who are perpetuating these circumstances. With the exception of perhaps Saudi Arabia in Yemen, we're not used to seeing states that are kind of on the global stage, that are allies with Western countries, seemingly purposefully enacting these policies themselves. So I think that this is kind of both a shift in practice of how war is waged, and also is kind of a wake-up call for humanitarian agencies, for human rights scholars, for really all of us in public health and others, that we need to be more forceful in the moment in calling out these actions, because weeks, months from now is too late.
Yara Aasi is a professor at the University of Central Florida and author of the book How War Kills: The Overlooked Threats to Our Health. Yara, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, well, your representatives in Washington are also talking about Gaza this week. Some of them are trying to permanently end funding for the United Nations' main Palestinian aid agency. That's one part of a spending deal and a seemingly constant battle in D.C. to keep the government running that Celeste and Deepa Fernandez will pick up with our regular politics roundtable when we return.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
There is a big rush in the Senate right now to pass a $1.2 trillion funding bill that would keep the lights on in the federal government past midnight when funding expires. It passed in the House this morning. And because of that, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene threw the lower chamber into chaos by filing a motion to vacate Republican Speaker Mike Johnson from his job.
He passed a budget that should have never been brought to the floor, did not represent our conference, and it was passed with the Democrats and without the majority of the majority.
What happens if he moves?
And in another fast-approaching deadline, Donald Trump has until Monday to put up some big money to stop his properties from being seized in New York. Let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. Isaac Arnsdorf is national political reporter for The Washington Post and author of a book that's coming out next month called Finish What We Started, about the MAGA movement. Hi, Isaac. And we'll get Isaac in a minute. Scott Wong is a senior congressional reporter for NBC News. Scott, welcome.
Hello, good to be with you.
So, Scott, let's get your quick take on this big budget bill. Is it going to pass the Senate by midnight to prevent a shutdown? What are you hearing there?
Yes, it will pass the Senate. The big question is, you're right, will it pass by the midnight deadline? It all depends on if they can get agreement from all 100 senators, but it looks to be on track. The House got it to them relatively early. They will have to work through some processes, but, you know, it looks to be on track. If there is a very brief shutdown, it could be, you know, hours long into the early morning. But you know, for all intents and purposes, I don't think any Americans will feel any sort of pain if funding lapses for a few hours.
Except for Congresswoman Green might feel some pain. As we mentioned, she filed that motion to vacate. So, Isaac, what happens next after that motion?
So this is not going to come up before the recess. So the House is going to be out for a few weeks, and they can deal with it when they get back. So that's the first thing. And then, you know, it's not totally clear, you know, like Scott said, a majority of Republicans didn't support this budget. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're all going to want to throw Mike Johnson out, especially since it wasn't that long ago that they went through this and ended up with Mike Johnson because they like couldn't figure anyone out. So I'm sure there are going to be a lot of Republicans who might not be happy with the spending bill, but also wouldn't love the spectacle of casting around for another speaker in an election year.
And okay, I was actually with Ms. Green, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a few minutes ago on the steps of the Capitol. And she is really upset about the fact that Johnson did this budget deal and relied mostly on Democratic votes. It bypassed all the normal procedures. It bypassed the Rules Committee. The majority of Republicans did not support it because they believe it did not cut spending enough, did not address border security enough. And what this act does, while Johnson is not under threat to be removed right now, House Republicans and senators as well will be leaving for a two-week Easter recess, their spring break, if you will. And so this hangs above Johnson's head for the next 2 weeks. It will be a major storyline. And guess who gets to be in the spotlight for the next 2 weeks? Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's concerned with spending, but also with funding for Ukraine, which she does not really want to see pass the United States Congress.
And Scott, given you were just with her, I'm very curious because we're reading that right after she filed the motion, she was swarmed by her Republican colleagues, many of whom trying to convince her not to do this. Do you think she's hearing them? Did she say anything about that?
She did. Yes, she was swarmed by Republican colleagues on the House floor. Obviously, people trying to understand what this was about, what her concerns were. Was she serious about forcing the actual vote on the floor? She basically, you know, has teed up this vote for when they return, but still can decide to pull back or to withdraw it. I talked to Mike Lawler. He's a moderate Republican from a very swing district, a vulnerable Republican. He said, look, what this does is it paints us as, you know, a chaotic conference. It undermines faith and from voters in the Republicans who hold this majority. And it's bad for the party. And so there's a lot of Republicans that clearly are not on board with what MTG is doing. There's also a number of Democrats that have indicated, mostly privately, that they are willing to join hands with some Republicans to save Mike Johnson in the event that this vote heads to the floor.
Yeah, and speaking of the Democrats, President Biden stepped up his campaigning this week. He visited Texas, Arizona, Nevada. He opened campaign offices, wanted to shore up support among Latinos who helped him win last time. Here he is in Reno.
And folks, you know, we're going to keep making the case for second term by lowering the cost and creating more jobs. You know, we have grassroots support.
He talked about American values, unions, jobs, bringing down drug prices, standing up to Russia in ways he says the former President Trump will not. He's trying to overcome concerns that he is not connecting with the voters. So, Isaac, how do you think he's doing?
Well, the Biden campaign is thrilled with how the past few weeks have been going pretty much since the State of the Union. They love the contrast that they've been drawing with Biden actually doing a lot more campaigning than Trump. And when Trump has been going out and doing these rallies, creating a lot of controversies with what he's been saying about January 6th or using the term bloodbath in Ohio last weekend. And so they feel like they're really since the primary ended and we've moved into the general election phase, now that both candidates have become the presumptive nominees, they really like actually the way that that's sort of reset the race and creating the contrast between Biden and Trump in that Biden and Trump that they want to see. They're not really seeing that show up in the polls as much as they'd probably like to quite yet. But it's still early, and the polls in the key states have been sort of a mixed bag. You can pick and choose.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. Maybe the polls are not showing it, but Biden made a lot of money. His campaign made twice as much in the last week, we're learning, than former President Trump has. Some of his money went to ads like this, which play back some of Trump's own comments about the pandemic.
And then I see the disinfectant. And is there a way we can do something like that? By injection inside or...
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your response to this crisis?
I'd rate it a 10. I think we've done a great job.
So I'm wondering, Scott, you know, campaign cash, is that a good way to measure where a campaign's at? I mean, we do know that Trump earns a lot of free media.
Yes. I mean, I think it's one measure that we should, take into consideration. Biden obviously announcing that he raised more than $50 million in the month of February. That's a big number that he put up, dwarfing the numbers coming from Trump world. However, I will point out, and this has been a discussion on Capitol Hill and throughout Washington, that Hillary Clinton also raised more money than Donald Trump in the 2016 campaign cycle. She did not end up winning the presidency. And so there's that. President Trump has a way of capturing media, capturing, you know, galvanizing support among his very loyal people, especially as he has been railing against some of the criminal charges that have been filed against him in various courts of law. And yeah. So, while it is one aspect that we need to consider, and the fact that President Trump has indicated that some of his campaign money will be going towards his legal defenses, that's another, challenge that he is dealing with. It cannot be overstated that, you know, Trump is an entirely different type of politician than we really have ever seen before.
And speaking of that, Isaac, the week started with Trump using, as we mentioned, some very heated rhetoric. Being divisive, that's hardly out of character. He also notably said this about a national abortion ban on WABC radio.
And it'll come out to something that's very reasonable. But people are really, even hardliners are agreeing, seems to be 15 weeks, seems to be a number that people are agreeing at.
There's not actually agreement on that. What do you make, Isaac, of Trump's messaging?
Well, the Biden campaign has just been clobbering him with that comment. Some other comments he made that seeming to take credit for the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade. And also a comment he made the other week suggesting that he'd be open to cutting Social Security, which is definitely off message for him. And they had a field day with that as well. So that, you know, all goes back into the way that they feel like they've really had a good few weeks. The money that we were talking about is a huge factor in why we've been actually seeing less of Trump. You know, those rallies are expensive to put on, and the campaign is really focused on trying to close that gap, and that means spending more time in private fundraisers.
And, you know, take us out just, Scott, with a quick take on Ukraine aid. Is it going to pass anytime soon? Some lawmakers are talking about making it a loan.
Yeah, actually, the loan idea is something that was floated by former President Trump himself to some Republican senators. It is an idea that is on the table. However, as I mentioned before, lawmakers are leaving for a two-week recess. So the soonest we will see a vote on critical funding for Ukraine in the House of Representatives will be sometime in mid-April at the earliest. This obviously comes as Russia has launched a barrage of new attacks on civilian targets and energy targets in Ukraine. Zelensky has said that, unless he gets aid from the U.S. and the West, there's a real possibility that they could lose the war.
That's right. Isaac Arnsdorf, a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Scott Wong is senior congressional reporter for NBC News.
Coming up next, that's enough news for today. It's Friday, and when we return, we're talking sci-fi and romance novels with producer Kalyani Saxena, who has two titles for your list. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether it's sci-fi, fantasy, or romance, genre fiction readers love a series. All that world-building for one book? Nah, keep them coming. So on that front, Here and Now producer Kalyani Saxena is here to talk about the latest installment in a new series of sci-fi novels that she's into. Hey, Kalyani.
Hi, Chris.
We're talking about the Devoured Worlds series from author Megan O'Keefe. And the third book in this series comes out in June. It's called The Bound Worlds. The first two installments came out last year, The Blighted Stars and The Fractured Dark. I read the first one on your recommendation and enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yay!
So thank you for that.
I'm so glad, actually, because it's one of those series where I'm not a big sci-fi reader. I used to be when I was a kid. You know, I loved the concept of two people stranded together in space, which is kind of what this book is about. But I fell off on reading sci-fi and someone recommended this to me. I happened to have had COVID and I was locked onto a balcony basically for like 4 hours at a time because my family was in a really small apartment. And this book is really what got me through those hours locked on a balcony.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad you're feeling better. Yeah, yes. I mean, I do read a fair amount of sci-fi, and I like, you know, this I would categorize as a space opera for getting super niche genre, which I like. Another series that people might have heard of called The Expanse. If people haven't read the books, they might know the Sci-Fi Channel show. I haven't seen the show. This reminded me of that because it's also like action-packed. It's got this intergalactic political intrigue and creepy planets with a little bit of cosmic horror in there.
So
why don't you give listeners a little elevator pitch? Why should people check this series out?
Yeah. You know, one thing I should say about this series, and I know you've only read the first book, Chris, so I'm not going to spoil anything, is that each book feels so different. And this first book feels almost like a haunted, like, horror story, but on, like, a closed planet. So we have these two people. We sort of start the book with Tarkin Mercator. He's part of this, one of the ruling families in this political system that sort of governs the galaxies that people live within. And he is sort of a scholar by nature. He doesn't really want to get involved in the family politics, but he's with his dad on this mission. And there's this terrorist, an environmental terrorist. Her name's Nyra Sharp. And she basically had accused his father of being involved in a really exploitative mining practice on these planets, which are called the Cradles, where human life is possible. And her accusation was that his father had something to do with this thing called the Shroud, which is really eating up all the, like, possible livable life on these planets. And Tarquin's kind of determined to show that she was wrong, that his father couldn't have had anything to do with this. And so he's on a mission to one of these cradles when the ship that he's on with his father explodes. And Nyra happens to be on that ship, but he doesn't recognize her, which is, maybe Chris, you can do a little bit of explaining about why exactly he doesn't recognize her or know her.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, there's a critical part of the plot, which is this reprinting process. That's kind of like this reincarnation through technology. And basically, people can have their consciousnesses reprinted into a new body after death. By the way, I haven't seen it, but I know the TV series Altered Carbon has a similar
concept. It's quite similar to that. And that's, I think, why it was so easy for me to understand. It's basically like your personality is stored in these neural maps, which are, you know, uploaded to a kind of a cloud-like system. And so if you die, then you can just get reprinted into a new body with that same map downloaded into the new body. But you, of course, have to back it up.
Yeah, and I think it's cool because it's fertile ground for some of that philosophical side of sci-fi that we love. I wrote down one passage. There's a character that's speaking about soldiers that get repeatedly killed and brought back by their kind of overlords to keep fighting. And the quote, so this character says, "There's a look you get after a while, a stain with every life taken, seeping through. People get to keep coming back as long as they can afford to reprint, but I don't believe the human heart has caught up with technology."
Yeah.
Kalyani, I thought this was a cool way to play with the ideas of the limits of science and whether consciousness is just an effect of neurochemical pathways or something more, you know?
And I think that's what worked so well about the book for me, actually, is this idea that, like, yeah, you have this really cool technology, but there are limits, right? And, like, you can't be violently killed again and again, or something happens to you, and it's called cracking within the book system, and it means basically your mind breaks. And the people who actually have access to printing are not, you know, it's not available to everyone. It's available to wealthy families like Tarquin and his father. There's some really interesting political themes.
Yeah, and you get a lot of that tension playing out between the two main characters. Tarquin, as he's described at one point, as a soft-skinned aristocrat unused to pain.
Yes.
And then his counterpart, Nyra Sharp, is this, like, rugged assassin and spy who's working against a capitalistic space cabal of aristocratic families. So
yeah,
it's fun to watch where that relationship goes without spoiling anything.
Without spoiling anything.
What are you looking forward to in the third installment of this, which comes out in June?
So I've already read the third. That's
one
of the great perks of this job. But so I can't, the thing is, like, I can't tell you anything about the third because everything that happens in the second is so crazy and, like, unpredictable that you will be gasping for air. Like, I finished the first book and I loved it, but it feels very much like a self-contained book. And it's like the seeds that are planted in book one really get fleshed out in books two and three. So it's, I think, readers who want a story that will surprise them with characters that have heart and themes that are really complex and don't have easy answers will really have a great time with this series.
And I'm always a fan of some imaginary biology, and there's a lichen in this book that is actually pretty important. So
yes, this is
I thought
this,
that was cool.
This goes out to all the plant lovers and the geologists. both of those things play an important role in the books.
So that's The Blighted Stars, the first in a series of sci-fi books, the third of which is coming out in June. But Kalyani, I know you also wanted to talk about another book, an older one from 2015.
Yes.
And it's a romance novel.
It is. I'm a big romance fan, and I've been reading a lot of historical romance in the last month. I think it's just something that brings me a lot of comfort. It is very formulaic, like romance is, but I think when you find a book that surprises you even within that formula. It's really refreshing to me, at least. And so this book is by Julie Ann Long. It's called It Started with a Scandal. And we follow this woman named Elise. And she, a few years before the start of the book, had an, I guess, out of marriage affair and got pregnant as a result. And so she's had a sort of plummet in social status. And now she has to take this job as a housekeeper for this really important guy. He's a prince. He's a French prince. His name is Philippe. And Philippe is really just like a standoffish, cold guy. He needs someone who can just take care of the house. And most people have already fled the job, but Elise really needs the job because she needs it for her and her son. And so she's determined to do a good job, which of course puts them in contention. And it's a really sweet romance between two people that takes its time to develop. And they're sort of stuck in this position of employer and employee, and they navigate that power dynamic as well in the book. It's really thoughtful and romantic and full of yearning. And I think just a good dose of escapism for anyone who's looking for it.
Here and Now producer Kalyani Saxena with some book recommendations for us. Thanks, Kalyani.
Thank you so much, Chris.
That'll do it for us. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Hafsa Qureshi and Lynn Menegon. Today's editors were Julia Corcoran, Todd Munt, and Micaela Rodriguez. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm off next week. Shirley Jihad will be your host, and we'll be back with you on Monday.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.